hear ye. All persons having business before this honorable court are admonished to draw near and give their attention as the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Good morning, all. The first case presented for argument this morning is Bartlett versus Battaglia. Mr. Weirig? All right.
May it please the court, my name is Matthew Weirig, counsel for appellant Jonathan Bartlett. My co-counsel, Amy Van Dyke, will be delivering the rebuttal argument. We're both third-year law students for the University of Notre Dame, arguing today by leave of this court.
Okay, welcome to the court.
And we're arguing under the supervision of attorney Robert Palmer. The Illinois Appellate Court's decision that appellant received a fair trial despite an improper quantification of the reasonable doubt standard by the prosecutor on rebuttal argument was contrary to In re Winship, Sullivan versus Louisiana, and Cage versus Louisiana, and additionally an unreasonable application of Darden versus Wainwright. We request that this court reverse the decision of the district court and grant appellant's petition for writ of habeas corpus. The Illinois Appellate Court improperly limited its analysis of the prosecutor's quantification of the reasonable doubt standard as a 30% puzzle of the Eiffel Tower to the Darden versus Wainwright harmless error standard. Since this case is materially indistinguishable from Cage, Sullivan, and In re Winship, their decision was contrary to established Supreme Court precedent. In Winship, Sullivan, and Cage, in all three cases, the Supreme Court assessed constitutionally deficient reasonable doubt instructions given by the judges in those cases and then later applied by the jury to secure convictions. In Winship, the judge delivered a preponderance of the evidence standard, while in Sullivan versus Cage, the judge compared the reasonable doubt standard to no actual or substantial certainty, but simply moral uncertainty. In both cases, the court held that due process protects against conviction by anything except for proof beyond a reasonable doubt on every fact necessary to constitute the crime. And in Cage, the court further elaborated that if a jury is misinformed, then all that matters is that a reasonable juror could have interpreted the instruction improperly.
Cage and Sullivan were improper jury instructions on reasonable doubt, not, as in this case, improper closing argument on reasonable doubt?
Correct, Your Honor.
And is there any authority for the extension of those two cases to the argument context?
Under the circumstances, although there is the factual difference between the argument being made by the prosecutor on rebuttal argument and the instruction being issued by the judge, based on the circumstances of the case, the same legal implication occurs in the present case, and that is the jury applied a constitutionally deficient reasonable doubt.
So your answer to the judge's question is no, there is no authority.
No, Your Honor.
We would have
you
to.
You mean yes, Your Honor?
Yes, Your Honor. No, Your Honor. Yes, there is no authority.
Correct.
The instructions in this case were appropriate. Correct.
Correct.
The instructions were fine.
Under Illinois law, the reasonable doubt is not specifically given instructions to by the judge, which
as a matter of fact, it's precluded from being given.
Correct, Your Honor. And that is one of the factors that makes this case materially indistinguishable from those cases where it was based on a judge actually giving the instruction to the jury. In the present case, the prosecutor's closing remarks were the last things heard by the jury, with the exception of the judge giving a brief statement instructing the jury that they should not consider anything presented by either of the two counsels as being considered for evidence. However, he did not issue a specific curative statement with regard to the improper quantification of the reasonable doubt standard. In addition, at the close of trial, the prosecutor in the case first quantified reasonable doubt as being comparable to a 30% completed puzzle of the Eiffel Tower, which, according to this case, according to this court in Glass, it was improper for them to define it at all. But furthermore, in United States versus Hall, specifically spoke to it being improper for counsel to quantify reasonable doubt by numerical standards. Furthermore, when the statement was made by the prosecutor at trial, the defense counsel objected to that statement, which the trial court overruled. A reasonable juror could interpret that as a ratification of the statement made by the prosecutor. And furthermore, when coupled with no curative instruction being later given, the lack of opportunity for the defense counsel to respond with a rebuttal argument or a curative statement of their own, in addition to no actual instruction being given by the judge, consistent with Illinois law regarding what constitutes reasonable doubt, these factors combine to the jury retiring to the courtroom to deliberate on the case based on the prosecutor's 30% standard of reasonable doubt.
You're right. Got 1 minute left.
Thank you, Your Honor. At the very least, even if this court was not to determine that it is contrary to the standard, at the very least, it's an unreasonable application of the Cage, Sullivan, and Winship line of cases for the Illinois appellate court's failure to extend that case. Consequently, we request that this court reverse the decision of the Illinois appellate court and grant the appellant petition for writ of habeas corpus.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Ms. Griffin.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Colleen Griffin from the Illinois Attorney General's Office on behalf of the respondent. First, the petitioner argues that the appellate court's decision was contrary to the Cage-Sullivan principles. However, the United States Supreme Court has never applied or contemplated Cage-Sullivan being extended to the situation where a petitioner is claiming that a prosecutor made an improper statement regarding anything. In order to grant habeas relief, a decision of the state court must be contrary to what clearly established United States Supreme Court precedents, and there's none in this case. The petitioner states that the facts of this case are materially indistinguishable from Cage and Sullivan because the prosecutor said the burden of proof was 30%. However, that's still, there's no United States Supreme Court precedent.
Well, he didn't say that, did he?
And that was the second point I was going to make. He never even said this.
I mean, the statement doesn't really make any sense, does it?
No. He talks about
it's certainly 30%. Not a correct statement of the law, but it's slightly odd.
Yes, he was basically responding to the defense counsel's argument that the burden of proof was a brick wall and that the state had to take out every brick of the wall in order to overcome the presumption of innocence. So the prosecutor responded by saying, you know, no, it's more like a puzzle. When you have, at the beginning, you have 30%, and then you move on, and basically ended with a statement that something's recognizable when it's recognizable. But in no way did the prosecutor quantify the burden of proof in this case. And in any event, you can't say that that would be comparable to a trial judge's instructions. They're just two totally different things. Again, the trial judge is instructing the jury that this is the law, you must follow this law. In this case, you have a prosecutor's argument, which can be assessed in light of all of the other evidence and circumstances in the trial. And again, as petitioner pointed out, the jury was specifically instructed in this case that any arguments not based on the evidence should be disregarded, and they're presumed to have followed that law.
That wouldn't cover this, though.
Well, it wasn't a statement based on the evidence. I mean, the jury wouldn't think that we were really talking about...
It was an analogy that was poorly drawn.
It was a poorly drawn analogy, yes. However,
do you believe the judge should have... ruled otherwise when the objection was made?
No, I don't, because when you look at where the objection was made in the context of the argument, first, what is happening is the prosecutor's responding, brick walls, this is not like brick walls, and it's then that the objection is actually made, and that was in direct response to the defendant's argument. Then the prosecutor continues with the alleged improper 30% statement, and an objection is not renewed at that point. So you can't even say that. The petitioner in his brief talks about the trial court endorsing the argument by failing to object, but there was never really an objection made at the point of the 30% statement. So at that point, the trial judge wasn't doing anything regarding the 30% statement because no objection to that actual statement had been made. And there's no reason to extend the principles in Cage and Sullivan to this type of situation because prosecutorial misconduct is covered by United States court rules, Darden versus Wainwright, and that provides a reasonable procedure to ensure that constitutional principles have been met. That Supreme Court precedent was applied by the Illinois Appellate Court, although they did not specifically cite to Darden. They did apply the correct legal principles involved and found that the statement did not deprive the petitioner of a fair trial. The court recognized that in context, the 30% argument did not go to the burden of proof, that it was not improper, and that decision was not outside the boundaries of permissible differences of opinion, as the district court in this case specifically recognized. So first, this decision of the appellate court was not contrary to Cage or Sullivan, and second, was not an unreasonable application of the Darden principles. So the respondent would ask that this court affirm the decision of the district court.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Thank Griffin. You. Ms. Van Dyke.
Good morning, Your Honors. Your Honors, we are not arguing that that Darden doesn't apply in many, many prosecutorial misconduct cases. It just is that in this particular case, the facts and circumstances have combined to create a legal implication such that it would be unreasonable for not to extend Cage and Sullivan. The Second Circuit has specifically stated in Kenaw v. Miller that a state court determination is reviewable under the AEDPA if the state decision unreasonably failed to extend a clearly established Supreme Court precedent. And in this case, as my partner has argued, it is unreasonable not to extend it. In addition, if we were not to extend Cage and Sullivan and apply the Darden standard, if you look at what the Illinois Appellate Court looked at, and more importantly, what they did not look at, they made an unreasonable they applied Darden unreasonably. One of the things they did not look at is the sequence of events, again, that my partner has gone over, the fact that there were no curative instructions. As you pointed out, the trial court judge did what he could, but he didn't specifically address the analogy, which is a quantification. What the prosecutor said is, you want to get 30% done. A reasonable juror is going to hear that sentence, you want to get 30% done, and is going to apply some meaning to that. Granted, the prosecutor did go on and left it an open amount, 10, 20, 30 pieces missing, but that still is a quantification of an unknown amount. What that does is it takes away the subjectiveness of the reasonable doubt standard and opens the door for a reasonable juror to likely think that you can convict can convict a defendant based on the quantity of evidence and not the quality. So we do, in fact, have a quantification of the reasonable doubt standard. And I think that sets this apart from many other prosecutorial misconduct cases, including those where there was an erroneous burden of proof alleged. The cases mentioned in the briefs by the government, none of those rose to the level of quantifying the burden of proof. In fact, many of the statements, such as those in Ruvalcaba, which was a case in this court, those were not even found to be improper by the court. So it's really hard to use that as a comparison of why Cage Sullivan shouldn't be used, or why we should not find prejudice when using the Darden standard, because those comments didn't rise to the level of unconstitutionality as the one in this case did. In addition, when we look at whether the defendant was prejudiced under the Darden standard, even the district court said that there was a significant risk that the jury would discount the significance of the prosecutor's burden. So I think we can look at that in terms of whether there was a reasonable likelihood that they did and whether a jury actually did under Darden. And if we look at the trial instructions that were given, it's just not clear that a juror, when being told to ignore everything that wasn't based on evidence, would automatically equate ignoring what would be a statement of law given by the prosecutor. A juror is going to assume that the prosecutor knows the law and is going to accurately state the law to them. And I think just the combination of the facts and circumstances in this case make it unique, so that A, Cage and Sullivan should be extended at the very least, and B, if we use the Darden standard, we see that the comments were improper and the defendant was prejudiced.
Do you think, Ms. Van Dyke, we should think a reasonable juror would believe that the prosecutor knows the law? Aren't the jurors told who gives the law and who doesn't?
I think that it is a reasonable juror is going to assume that a representative of the state is not going to mislead them in terms of what the law is, even though they understand that the judge is the ultimate arbiter of that law, especially given the fact that the judge could not say, here is an example of reasonable doubt. In Illinois, he could not do that. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Van Dyke. The case is taken under advisement.